Call the State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Committee to...
Teeing it up.
And we will first take a look at and approve the minutes from March 4th.
Mr. Chair, also move the minutes for March 4, 2009.
Senator Betzold moves adoption of the minutes from the March 4th State and Local Government. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. And we will take up Senate File 538. Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Senate File 538 is a proposal to change the timing during which a job applicant's criminal history background check becomes involved in the hiring process. It's part of a broader effort to facilitate reentry into the community for those who are released from custody in the state of Minnesota. As you can imagine, sometimes it's difficult to get even past the first stage of the application process for a new job if you've gotten convictions on your record, and even if you are otherwise quite qualified for the job. So sometimes it's not because of any particular problem with your application. It's just so much easier sometimes to screen out those who have that criminal history and not have to deal with that in the application process. So the bill before you would provide that that cannot be used. The background check cannot be considered in the application process until later in the process. I do have a couple of author's amendments, one of which redefines the timing in that process. So I'd ask the committee to consider the 1702.
It's yet.
Author's amendment. I'm sorry.
We'll get those distributed.
Let's see here. A1 would be the first amendment, please. Okay.
This is the first committee you've been up in with this, Senator Latz.
Yes,
so
Mr.
these
Chair.
Are author's amendments.
Yes.
Everyone have the A1 amendment? Senator Betzold moves the A1 amendment for Senator Latz. All those in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Latz, you said you had a couple?
Yes, there's one other amendment,
shape.
A2. Would you like me to explain the author's amendment?
Yeah, explain the bill with the author's amendments in it and what A2 does.
The A2 amendment would exempt the Department of Corrections from complying with this because of their unique concerns as an agency, and it would put them on equal footing, equal treatment as other law enforcement agencies in the state of Minnesota that are completely exempt from this chapter.
Okay. So we have the A1 adopted. We have the A2 before us. Senator Betzold moves the A2 amendment.
A2. Yeah. I don't have the A2.
Oh. Coming around.
Just have the
we'll
A1.
Wait until everyone has it.
Did we already adopt the A1?
Yes. She can only move so fast.
Right. You just got it.
Thank you.
Senator Betzold renews his motion that A2 be adopted. All those in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. We have the bill in shape. And I think you, Senator Latz, did you have other comments on the bill?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. The A1 amendment identified or changed the original bill in terms of when the employer may be able to use the background check. The original version of the bill provided that they couldn't do that background check to screen someone out until after they had offered the job to an applicant. That's at odds with the way the city of St. Paul does it, and we thought earlier in the process would be more appropriate, even though not at the beginning. The A1 amendment said that they can conduct the background check when the applicant has been selected for an interview by the employer. So that first round of screening, that first cut on the resumes that come in, the applications that come in, you can make it through that and get to the interview stage without getting sort of automatically or inappropriately screened out because of your your history. But once you get to the interview stage, everything's on the table. But that will also give the applicant an opportunity to have the face-to-face explanation of their own history, and it opens up the discussion. So, members, this applies to public employers only. It does not apply to the private sector. And public employers, jurisdictions that already use this process include the city of Minneapolis, St. Paul, Boston, Chicago, San Francisco, and the entire state of Hawaii. So this is something which is already tried and proven and would be very helpful to the community that really we want the community who comes out of the correctional system to be able to get jobs. Because if they can't, they are much more likely to go back into the correctional system with more victims along the way, too. So with that said, we've got a couple of witnesses we'd ask the committee to hear from. One is Councilmember Elizabeth Glidden of Minneapolis City Council. I'd like to invite Councilmember Glidden to come forward. And then also Eric Branson, who's the employment facilitator with Emerge Community Development. If Mr. Branson could come forward as well. And then when they're done, Mr. Chair, we have one person who has experienced this situation from the employee application side for just a moment or two to share with you her experience as well.
Thank you. Ms. Glidden, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and offer your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Elizabeth Glidden. I am a council member for the city of Minneapolis, the 8th Ward, which is the south part of Minneapolis, including a portion of Lake Street. And I want to thank the chair, committee members, and Senator Latz for inviting me to testify today. Because I will say that in the city of Minneapolis, we are quite proud to say that the door is open just a little bit wider for individuals with a criminal record to become employed by the city. It was in 2006 that Councilmember Don Samuels, who represents the city's north side, and I met with the Council on Crime and Justice and our own city's Human Resources Department to discuss a change to our hiring practices that would remove from the city application the box which requires disclosure of past criminal history. This was a change that was approved in December of 2006 by a unanimous council and with the support of our mayor, and I think it's important to say also with the support of our Human Resources Department. Under our Fair Hiring Practices resolution, background checks are still performed, but only after a conditional job offer has been made. We have also made special efforts to do a better job of evaluating what jobs should require a background check. So this was something that was part and parcel of our actions on the Fair Hiring Practice resolution. Now, at the time that we adopted this, we were certain that it was the smart thing to do. We thought it was a change that would improve quality of life for individuals with a criminal record. And we also knew that for many people who had been convicted of offenses throughout the state of Minnesota, many of them do move to Minneapolis to begin their lives anew. And so we thought this would be a change that also would strengthen our communities by allowing people to apply and to be judged on their skills. And we thought it would send a loud and a clear message to those who are trying to live productive lives after time behind bars that we wanted them to succeed. We wanted them to find productive employment. Today, I can report to you that we have the results of 2 years of history on this and that we can confirm this was a decision that benefited the city of Minneapolis. You have before you a chart that was prepared by our own city Human Resources Department. I'm just going to reference a couple of the results from this. One of the results that we found from implementation over the past couple of years was that fewer applicants to the city of Minneapolis are being rejected due to a criminal conviction. And this is by comparing our data before 2006 and after 2006. A second important result was that at the time that we adopted this, I have to say that we were unclear on how this might affect the work of our Human Resources Department. We did not know if it might increase workload for our employees there or how this might all play out. our Human Resources Department has, in fact, now determined that considering this criminal conviction information at the time of the job offer has actually decreased the amount of transactional workforce staff. And so in that sense, it has been some cost savings for the city of Minneapolis. Finally, we have in the city of Minneapolis, I think, a lot of concerns about how quickly does the hiring process move through with, you know, what is essentially a public bureaucracy. And a third important result was that reviewing convictions at the job offer stage has not slowed down the hiring process for the city of Minneapolis. So in closing, I would just say that the bill you're considering will provide very positive change for people who are trying to do the right thing, essentially become productive members of their communities. And from the perspective of the city of Minneapolis, we are pleased with how this has impacted our hiring practices, and we are especially pleased that this has produced results that we're able to share with you. And so thank you for this opportunity. I'm available for questions if you have them.
Madam Chair?
Yeah, Senator Betzel.
Where are we? Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Councilmember Glidden, you did make a reference to the box, and, you know, I started getting these emails saying, ban the box, and I had no clue.
Me either.
No clue what they were talking about. I finally was able to track down the bill. It doesn't refer to boxes. I got this this handout from the Council on Justice and Crime and Justice. It says, ban the box. It doesn't refer to boxes anywhere. I did look at, you do use the term, and as I'm looking at this flyer by the city of Minneapolis, it says the city removed the criminal conviction disclosure box. So I'm getting it, but I think somebody's just being a little too cute in their marketing. Just what was in this disclosure box that everybody says ban the box, but nobody understood when I got back to them and asked them, what are you talking about? They didn't know.
This was a marketing campaign, and we actually called our own resolution something a little bit different, fair hiring practices. But on many job applications, not just for public employers but private employers too, there is often a question that says with a checkbox next to it, have you ever been charged with a crime? Or have you ever been convicted of a crime? It might be either one of those different types of questions. And so this was the campaign that I think that phrase started in California with ban the box. Ask the question later in the process.
Okay. Well, just a comment, Mr. Chair.
Senator Betzold.
Whoever is maybe in the room that is promoting that, I think that they may want to provide legislators a little bit more information as it's proceeding, not just say ban the box, because that didn't tell me anything. Now, I understand what you're saying. I just didn't understand ban the box. So thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions of Councilmember Glidden? Mr. Branson, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Eric Branson, and I am employed by Emerge Community Development. I would like to thank you for having me here today. I'm an employment facilitator at Emerge Community Development, and a large part of my job involves assisting ex-felons in obtaining gainful employment. As you can imagine, this is a task that has many hurdles. One such hurdle my clients face is the question on employment applications that asks about an applicant's criminal history, and this is why I'm here to talk to you today. There are several reasons why this question on employment application impacts the population that I work with. The first reason is the upfront discrimination associated with this question. The discouragement and fear of rejection are very real and oftentimes result in a feeling of hopelessness when it comes to the job search process. The second reason that this question poses a problem is that often persons' criminal background is looked at more closely than a person's actual skills and qualifications. I, too, am an ex-felon and have been denied employment as a result of having to check the box. Luckily, I have had the support from persons willing to speak on my behalf of my past employment experiences, as well as an employer who values my knowledge, skills, and abilities more than what a piece of paper states that I did in the past. However, if no one would have given me that chance for an interview, I would not be where I am today. My experience both as an applicant and as an employment counselor I have come across this question worded in very vague and confusing ways. For example, it may read something like, have you ever been convicted of a felony in the last 7 years? And this can create confusion both for the applicant and for the individual screening the applications. Basically, what I'm asking you to consider is not to ban the discussion of an individual's criminal history, but simply take this question off of applications so that it cannot be used as a tool for discrimination and so that the applicant can be judged on their merit, qualifications, and skills. This legislation would improve the lives of my clients. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Branson. And then, Senator Latz, you had one more testifier in support. Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Mr. Branson. Last summer in my other job, I guess, one of my assignments was to hire some more mechanics. And in our field, I guess a criminal record isn't – I mean, there's quite a few people in the field that may have a background that may not be that stellar. But I found that, you know, when I was interviewing those folks and they were able to explain to me, you know, what was what they might have done, been in jail for or something like that, that many times it wasn't relevant to the job. So I'm trying to see if that's the point you're trying to get with this, or because at some point down the line they've got to explain, you know, what happened, why they were in jail, and what I'm hearing you say is that at least get us a chance to explain more thoroughly than just checking a number in a box.
Yes, thank you, Senator. Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. Because once you can get your foot in the door and actually get an interview, you know, it's a lot easier for the person to maybe explain some discrepancies on their actual criminal background. And it also gives the employer a chance to put a face with the name and, you know, judge the person based on their skills and qualifications and not necessarily, you know, what they have done in the past. And, you know, obviously there's going to be some types of employment that, you know, require, you know, certain things not being your background, and I'm fully aware of that. But it just is basically a tool to make the playing field a little more even so that the person can get a chance to come face-to-face and interview.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. During the last year and a half, a number of us served on the Commission to End Poverty, and one of the things that we found repeatedly in our tours around the state and talking to people who were living in poverty was that criminal backgrounds were really a huge barrier for employment. And in fact, many of the people who had those backgrounds stayed in poverty for many, many years, unable to get employment. And so I welcome this, but I do welcome the amendments that you offered, Senator Latz. I do think that you shouldn't have to be given an offer of employment before you can ask about that. I think the interview process is an appropriate time for that, and the face-to-face contact is an important time to interact and explain what happened in your past and let the potential employer ask some questions about that. So I think that this is a good way to start addressing that issue, which we saw as a big problem across the state of Minnesota as we try to address the issue of poverty.
Thank you. Any other questions? We have one more testifier in support of the bill. Is that right?
Yes. I'd like to welcome Lisa Jackson.
Ms. Jackson, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Hello. My name is Lisa Jackson. I'm here today to represent the Ban the Box. I'm a woman that has been incarcerated for 4.5 years. The 4.5 years that I was incarcerated, I totally changed my life. I guess I can say prison rehabilitated me. You know, I went through schooling. I went through all of the programs. I did all of the right things. I came out thinking things would be better. I have a son that I left when I went to be incarcerated. I came out expecting to be a mother, to have a good job, and to move on with life. That didn't happen. I remember a time going to Walmart to fill out an application, and there was a three-part interview. The whole application wasn't there at first. It was just testing. So I did testing, and I met with a manager, and she said, "Oh, my God, you're great. We would love to have you to work for our company." I had a second interview. They were very excited about that. My third interview got to the district manager, and he looked down at my application, and he saw that I had been convicted of a felony. And he told me, "Well, right now, we're not hiring it at this time." When I know they was hiring because the other people told us that, you know, it was during Christmas time. So when he looked at that box and saw that I was a convicted felon, he didn't give me a chance. So I'm here to say today that if we can get a chance to show who we are and how we've changed our life, I'm not saying that a bank robber should go and work in a bank. But I'm just saying that we should have the opportunity to go in, to show the person who we are, the qualifications that we have, the skills that we have, and that we can be a great asset to a company. Only because we got a felony on our record, it holds us back from everything. I mean, if we don't get decent employee, and I'm just speaking in general, if you come out of prison and you don't get a decent employee, that sends you back out into the street. And, you know, and we are here to rehabilitate ourselves and to clean up ourselves and to do better. And every door is being shut in our faces because of that box. And I believe today, if that box wasn't there, I believe if a person, I went into an interview and a person interviewed me and found out who I was and the qualities that I had, I really believe that I would get past and I would really get an opportunity to have a job offer. But because of that box today, it's not happening.
Thank you, Ms. Jackson.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Betzold.
If I understand the bill correctly, first of all, this wouldn't have applied to your situation because this applies to a public employer. It sounds like you applied to Walmart, so it would have not applied. But and second, it's out, with the amendment we adopted, by the, you would gotten a face-to-face interview at which time you were told that they told you're not hiring. So I'm not quite sure how this would have changed your situation the way that this bill is.
Well, that was just only one particular.
Go ahead.
Oh, that was only just one particular experience. I've been to many different companies. I've been out of prison for 5 months now, and I can tell you I've applied for over probably 70 different jobs. I've been on the Internet, applying on the Internet, and no calls backs, no interviews, no nothing. Everything has just been shed in my face, even McDonald's.
Thank you. I think the point is this is not a fix-all solution, as Senator Roebling was saying. It's kind of just a starting point, and there are a set of jobs that wouldn't have this question asked. Any other questions of members? Senator Latz?
Mr. Chair, I do have a question.
Senator Betzel.
I do have a question for Senator Latz. If this is adopted, then during the application process, we could not require anybody in the written application to disclose whether or not they've got a criminal background. But they would have to disclose it at least by the time they get to the face-to-face interview, which is presumably not going to be in writing. What if during the face-to-face interview the applicant kind of downplays it, maybe doesn't disclose everything, and you don't have it in writing? So you just proceed, and later on you find out that it was a little bit more serious what the application disclosed orally. I'm hoping the employer would take the steps to do the more thorough background check, but if you just take the word of the person and the person says, well, it really wasn't that big of a deal, and it was, how do you know if you're not going to require anything in writing? I'm just not sure how the mechanics work here.
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Betzold, the employer would not be allowed to inquire into or consider the criminal record or history until after the applicant has been selected for an interview by the employer. That was the A1 amendment's language. So presumably, I suppose, after they've been selected for an interview, they could require a written disclosure or a release if they needed one to get a criminal history check. But at least they've made that first cut. And they've already made some consideration that this applicant is otherwise qualified and worthy of a follow-up interview. It's you know, it's not going to stop discrimination from happening against people that have criminal histories. And it doesn't say that even public employers can't consider the criminal history in making the employment decision. But it is saying give them a chance to get past that first level of screening. And because that's so often, that's the level at which everyone with a criminal history gets weeded out. They never get even a second look. When you've got lots of applicants that don't have a criminal history, it's so easy just to say anyone with a criminal history we're not even going to consider.
But again, Mr. Chair, Senator Less, to be clear, because the language doesn't seem to reflect this, if the applicant gets to the face-to-face interview, then at that point the employer could require written disclosure of the background?
Senator Chairman, Senator Betzel, that is correct. The language does not specify that they can't. I would expect that they will. And certainly if there is any misrepresentation, either on a written disclosure or in an oral interview with regard to a criminal history, that alone would be ample ground for rejecting an application, that they have been untruthful or arguably untruthful in their interview process, regardless of their other qualifications.
Well,
Senator Betzel.
Mr. Chair, Senator Letts, my concern would be that, you know, during the oral interview, if you don't have anything in writing, later on, the applicant could say, well, of course they disclosed everything, when that may or may not have taken place, and then there'll be maybe some confusion later on if you don't have something in writing as to what the facts were. And as I say, I would guess most employers are probably going to insist at that stage to have it in writing so that you don't have the situation where, you know, there's a conflict as to whether this was disclosed or was not disclosed. So,
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Latz.
That would be advisable for any employer with regard to any qualification for a job applicant to have it in writing.
So okay. Senator Latz, your vision of the public employer when they can inquire after the application has been selected past the first phase, your vision is that this inquiry would be made in writing. There would be something at the application that would be other than oral.
Mr.
You'd fill
Chairman,
in a form.
Yeah, the bill does not propose to require that it be in
right.
writing, but I would think any employer, be good practice
that's just
to do it in writing,
it.
Especially public employers as well that tend to for sure have a human resources
yes.
department advising them or employment lawyers that would certainly say put the request in writing. But I should also comment that this does, number one, what the public employers do can be viewed as a best practice for private employers. So even though this does not apply specifically to private employers, as private employers start to see that the government is doing it, that it's not impeding the work of the government, in fact, it's in some ways it's saving costs and so on, it will be an example that can be set for the private employers. And secondly, it does not prohibit the prospective employer from considering the criminal history of the applicant. It only specifies a stage at which it will begin to be considered. And for those jobs that for which there is a statute that prohibits their employment if they have a certain kind of criminal conviction, does not change that. So you would not have a bank robber even getting past the first stage. Or at least, let's say, if in the disclosure, pre-interview, but after they've been selected for an interview, that they've got a statutorily prohibited conviction, they're never going to get the interview.
Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Latz, I'm sorry, I didn't catch the name of your witness.
Ms. Jackson.
Ms. Jackson. How far were you able to pursue your education while you were in prison?
I gained 2 years of college credits.
That's great. That's great. You know, I think it's not – the problem right now is it's not just ban the box. It's also a very bad economy, and a lot of people are losing their jobs. So it might be a good time for you to finish college and
yes.
get the next 2 years under your belt.
Thank you.
So advice from the chair of the higher ed committee. It's good advice.
And there's lots of grants available.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Day.
I hate to even comment because I know I'm going to get in trouble.
Uh-oh.
I'm trying to think of, so two applicants go in. So let's say they're both 30 years old. So one person has a clean history. He has no clean, whatever. And he's sitting there and he wants a job. You have somebody that also goes in, and we have, so that person has been in prison for 5 years, which has cost us probably $150,000, and we've given somebody a couple-year education. I'm trying to, is that a level playing field? I mean, I kind of understand what you're trying to do, and I've always wished that prisons and private companies would get together and work out a program where there would be a place to go after people get out of prison. But I'm thinking if I'm one of the applicants and I don't get the job, and the other person gets the job, what am I going to think then? What will I think then? Senator Latz. Fire away.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Day, you might think that you weren't otherwise quite as qualified as that person who spent 5 years in prison. Because spending 5 years in prison does not necessarily mean that you're not qualified for any particular job. Some people make good use of their time in prison, like Ms. Jackson did. Other people might not make such good use of it, but they're going to be out in the community. And we can either consign them to no employment future, in which case they're going to go back to criminal ways, which serves none of us, or we can at least level the playing field at the application stage for employment, which will serve all of us well. They may not get the job. They're more likely to get a job because at least they'll get their foot in the door for consideration. If they get a job and they're more likely to remain law-abiding, aren't we all better off? It's cheaper to do that, even if it's a public job, than to send them back to prison for another 5 years and spend another $150,000 on them.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz, if you're interviewing people for employment, don't you want to know quite a bit about them? I mean, you say that and here you can't even ask or they can't tell you about their background. So
interview point.
Prior to the
this, they can after.
During the interview, they can.
No, we added an amendment.
After we've taken the application and after the interview, I would think that anybody, any city in America, that would seem to me that would be just major open up. If somebody interviewed me and said, you got the job, and then I said, by the way, I've been in prison 7 years, and they said, no, you don't have the job,
Senator Day,
I would think that you would have
the A1 amendment did address that specific issue. It is now you can apply for the job.
Right.
Okay, and then if they say you meet the first cut, we're going to call a group of people in for applications. Right. They can ask you right then. It's
at that time.
Yeah, that was the A1 amendment.
Okay, without telling them they have the job.
Right. Right. It's okay. way before okay. They've already done all the interviews
okay.
and asked and actually figured out that they're offering the job to somebody. And it was specifically for some of those
okay.
concerns.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Yes, Senator Day.
And I guess
but
the other
still
question
have more. Okay.
Oh yeah.
Senator Day.
The other question I have is that if we have cities and counties and whoever that is, why do we need a state law? Why can't we just allow cities and counties or whoever might want to do this, which I take it that Minneapolis is already doing it? Why do I need to say that the city of Owatonna or Steele County should have to do it? If the city of Minneapolis wants to do it and Hennepin County wants to do it, or if Steele County and Owatonna wants to do it, why is it that I want to sit here and say the whole state has to do it?
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Day, if it's a good employment practice for government, and I think this would be, then I submit it should apply statewide. Secondly, we have people with criminal convictions who live all over the state. And the effect of not having it statewide could be twofold. Either the folks in Owatonna are going to be left with an underclass of those with criminal convictions who can't find jobs but are still living in the community, possibly preying on other members of the community because they need to eat or whatever, or they'll all migrate to the cities that do give them a fairer shot at getting a job, neither of which I think is a fair burden or a fair outcome. for the statewide community. Ms. Jackson wanted to add something.
Ms. Jackson.
I'm sorry, Senator Day, you said something earlier about if a convicted felon went in to apply for a job and someone that wasn't a convicted felon goes in to apply for a job. My question is, where does the punishment stop at? I mean, you know, you get sentenced to a sentence, you go in, you do that sentence, you do all that you're supposed to do, and then you come out. Where does the punishment stop? It just continue. Where does it stop at?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Day.
I don't know where it stops at, but it's you know, if you have a lifetime of experiences, you just have an awful lot of things. I might be elected state senator in my district, but I'm sure there's a lot of employers that probably wouldn't want to hire me for a lot of different things. So I don't know where, you know, when you say something stops that, I don't know where that might be, but yeah.
Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Latz, I'm going to be very supportive of this, but I do have a question because one of the things on a job application that's probably maybe more important even than are you a prior convicted felon is what have you done for your work history? You know, and if somebody's, you know, they worked at McDonald's, they did this, they did that, and then all of a sudden there's a five-year space with no work, I think that's going to draw kind of a red flag right there. So I guess I'd like to know what your thoughts are on that.
And I should mention to members, we do have a very long agenda and one other person that would like to testify. But Senator Latz, your thoughts on Senator Olsen's question?
Say that, Mr. Chairman, Senator Olsen, you can't fix everything. The fact is they were out of the community for 4.5 years, and they're going to have to explain it. But Ms. Jackson has some interesting information to share with you on that point.
I was incarcerated at Federal Alderson Prison Camp for Women. The 4.5 years that I was there, I worked. I worked for the 411 operator. I did 411 calls. I received 411 calls. I also worked for the distribution department, where I sorted and labeled and sent mail to the post office to be delivered. So there was no really gap in employment. So you do work in prison. So prison do really rehabilitate people, you know. And I think we deserve a chance. I think we deserve a second chance to come back out in society and fit in and to do good and to get decent jobs so we can take care of our families and to take care of ourselves.
Thank you, Ms. Jackson. We do have one more witness who's requested to testify, Keith Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, members, Ann Finn from the League of Minnesota Cities is also joining me. I'm Keith Carlson from the Minnesota Intercounty Association. And it frankly pains me to say that we do have concerns regarding this bill. And it pains me to say that because the lion's share of individuals on probation, on supervised release in the state, are not supervised by the Department of Corrections. They're supervised by county employees. And so we have a very high interest in seeing that these individuals do become fully employed. However, I have to state that for exactly the same reasons that the Department of Corrections asked for an exception to this bill, we believe it's appropriate to grant us exceptions, at least for certain positions. As I indicated, probation officers may be Department of Corrections employees, but in the majority of the circumstances in the state, they're county employees. And it just may not be appropriate to hire those individuals for those positions. In addition, for individuals who serve in our jails, as jailers or bailiffs, those individuals may or may not be licensed police officers. Again, there's an issue as to whether or not it's appropriate for hiring people with criminal history for these positions. I will further go on and indicate there are a number of positions where there is not a statutory ban, just as the ones that I just went through, where it may well not be appropriate to allow individuals with past criminal histories. individuals or positions who deal with individuals who are vulnerable adults, who have suffered potentially some disabilities. It may or may not be appropriate. The last issue I want to address is I did circulate this bill among members of our Human Resources Committees. All 13 of our counties, as well as Ramsey County and the Metropolitan Council, participate in that committee and meet on a monthly basis to go over issues of concerns to the Human Resources Departments of those respective jurisdictions. An issue that was raised to me by the Met Council was that currently, for example, for bus drivers, they are doing criminal background checks and also doing drug tests simultaneously on these individuals that are applying as drivers for the Met Transit system. Obviously, there's a cost involved above and beyond the staff cost for screening these applications for the drug test. And frankly, they said, you know, were they to be subject to this provision, they are now put in a position that they'll do the drug test first, they'll incur the cost for that, the individual perhaps get through the screening at this point, and then be brought into the interview, and then they find out that the individual has a criminal background, and they may disqualify them for that position after going through this expense. So those are our concerns, our objections to the bill. Again, I'm sorry, it does pain me to say that because we do have empathy with the goals of the legislation. But in practicality, there are many situations where we just do not think it's appropriate to not know the criminal background of the applicant at the time of the application.
Okay.
In order to keep things moving, Ms. Finn with the cities, we'll sure. Take your testimony and then take questions for those.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Ann Finn. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities, and I will be brief. As Mr. Carlson did, we have distributed this legislation to our human resources professionals within the city community, and we got a couple of themes that came back. One is that local units of government can already do what Senator Latz's bill does. They have this authority under their existing authority. And in fact, many are exercising the same practice that the bill would mandate. Secondly, there are those out there who think that mandating this practice would make their hiring practices less efficient. They think that there would be occasions where they are wasting time of both the employer and the applicant if they get them into the interview process and discover that there is some criminal history that would make them an unfavorable candidate for the job. I do want to thank Senator Latz for accommodating some of our concerns with the A1 amendment. We think that this moves us significantly in the right direction. And that said, we think there probably will still be some human resources professionals in our city community that still are uncomfortable with the bill and would like to have the option of doing a background check earlier in the employment process. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mrs. Finn. Senator Rust?
No, never mind.
Senator Latz, care to respond?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me first point out that Department of Human Services licensed positions are already exempt from Chapter 364, so this bill would not apply to DHS licensed positions. Also, law enforcement agencies, as defined in Chapter 626.84, Subdivision 1, paragraph F, are also not covered by this chapter of law. So it doesn't state any particular position within law enforcement agencies, all law enforcement agencies that are exempt under 626.84 apply. And I will tell you who that means. A unit of state or local government authorized by law to grant full powers of arrest to and charge a person with the duties of preventing and detecting crime and enforcing the general criminal laws of the state. And it applies to federally recognized tribes. So it doesn't say it's got to be the person who's a licensed peace officer conducting the arrest. It's the unit of state or local government that's authorized to grant full powers of arrest. So the entire police department, the entire sheriff's department, regardless of position, would be exempt from this Chapter 364 and from the bill that you have in front of you. Also, school bus driver endorsements are exempt from Chapter 364 and also would not be applicable in this situation.
Thank you, Senator Lenz.
Mr. Chair, can I just respond? Probation officers are not employees of the sheriffs. It is a separate department, either of the Community Corrections Agency or of the courts in our county, so they are not exempted out by that provision.
Okay.
And just, Senator Lenz, in response to that, this is not saying that the county has to hire a probation officer with a criminal history. It's just saying give them a chance to get their foot in the door for an interview. Actually, maybe they'd speak with a little more credibility to some of the probationers that they're talking with.
Chairman, is there a motion?
Senator Rust. Senator Rust.
Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate File 538, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Judiciary.
On that motion, everyone understand the motion? Senator Rust moves Senate File 538, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to Judiciary. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Latz.
Thank you, Member.
I'll take it then. Thank you, Tony. Senator Higgins. Senator Higgins brings us Senate File 536. Senator Higgins.
When does it come out of elections? She doesn't get best vote.
Have a good one.
Madam Chair and committee members, I have Senate File 536. This bill would allow government entities, including cities, the state, the University of Minnesota, and MNSCU, to adopt policies that would require people or entities who contract with the government unit to hire a certain number of low-income persons, former offenders, or in the case of cities, low-income city residents, in the performance of the construction or services contracts. This is not a mandate. It's not a requirement to the city and states, but rather it allows them to establish the practice and, if they do, sets certain parameters. The bill would also allow the governmental unit to impose penalties, including civil penalties, and restrictions on future contract agreements. The bill also stipulates that persons would be hired for the duration of the contract, not just for a certain number of hours, only then to be laid off. The intention of the bill is to allow the hiring of groups such as city residents, low-income persons, and former offenders who might not otherwise benefit from new projects and developments. And I think this is particularly timely with the stimulus projects that are going to be happening all around the state. Cities across the United States, such as Denver, Boston, San Diego, are establishing policies that expand employment opportunities for city residents, low-income people, and former offenders. I have two testifiers here with me today. Mr.
Senator Higgins, before we do that, we'd like to delete everything amendment. Senator Lori, on behalf of the author, moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We now have before us the A2 amendment as the core of the bill and the bill summary reflects the delete everything amendment. Senator Higgins, your witnesses.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have with me Steve Thomas, who's the president and CEO of the Network for Better Futures in my district, and Roosevelt Gaines, who's a trade specialist at the Minneapolis Urban League, also in my district. Mr. Thomas?
Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Thomas, welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Steve Thomas, and I'm the president and chief executive officer of the Network for Better Futures. A one-minute background on my organization. We're sponsored by seven leading nonprofits in the Twin Cities, and we've got three goals: reduce spending on expensive public services, create new jobs for high-risk adults, and achieve much better results for these adults in terms of public safety, health care, and employment outcomes. We do this by enrolling high-risk men and immediately offering access to affordable housing, short-term work, health care, behavioral health care services, and a community experience. A core feature of our enterprise is Better Futures Enterprises, which employs high-risk men on supervised work crews and we offer these work crews to private employers throughout the Twin Cities. And it's based on that experience that we are wholeheartedly endorsing this legislation and encourage you to support it. And we thank Senator Higgins for her leadership on this. There's several reasons why we believe this would be very beneficial to local and state entities. First, in the case of high-risk men who are enrolled in our enterprise, a targeted employment strategy like proposed in this bill would generate income not only for the workers, but the government and the community reaps the benefits such as increased child support payments and reduced use of public benefits. And our first year of experience proves that this, in fact, is a benefit that is incurred in, for the state and for localities. Another benefit is that employment is known to help reduce return-to-prison rates for ex-offenders. In fact, it may be one of the single most important reasons for reducing recidivism. Another key benefit is that a targeted employment tactic like this helps to break down the barriers to securing jobs for ex-offenders. Right now, all of our work crews are working for private employers, and every one of those employers have commented that now that they've had an opportunity to work with ex-offenders, they're much more likely and open to employing ex-offenders for their full-time work. And then lastly, by using this tool, ex-offenders and other high-risk adults with poor employment histories, it creates an intangible benefit that comes from working and supporting your family. But I think overall, the most important reason and the greatest benefit that could perhaps be accrued from this legislation is that it comes at no cost to the state or the locality. In fact, the states and localities are going to spend money on many of these endeavors to begin with. So by targeting the jobs, some of the low-skilled jobs in the case of our men, not only for no cost generates the benefits of employing a chronically unemployed person and converts them from an expensive consumer of public services to a taxpayer that's paying child support and becoming more active in a positive way as a worker in their community. So thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Roosevelt Gaines, and I'm with the Minneapolis Urban League. I'm a trade specialist at the Urban League. The Urban League has been involved in helping minorities and women and others seek employment and find employment in the building and construction trade for over 46 years. I am just pleased to see some legislation like this trying to go through because of the day-to-day job that I have at the Urban League of trying to get contractors and city contractors to comply and hire minorities and women. They're constantly not meeting goals. I mean, constantly. We hear so often at the Urban League that, you know, look, I come out my door every morning. There's a crew of 20 guys putting in the sidewalks in front of my house, and not one person of color or female on that project. You know, it's a perfect opportunity for the state, you know, to implement something because what I see is all of the governmental agencies. It can be the county, it can be the city, it can be the state, it can be MnDOT, it can be the Metropolitan Airport Commission, it can be the Park and Recreation Board. No one right now is meeting goals on hiring people from the inner city areas. There just got to be something done, okay? And the Urban League, you know, has tried on many occasions to get contractors to come on board and hire people, but something's got to happen from this side of the river that says to contractors, you know, now is the time, especially with the stimulus package. I think it's great we're going to have a stimulus package and the green jobs and transportation, but I'm hoping that we won't only see green-white jobs, but we'll see green-black jobs for people of color and women, because what will happen here with the state, you award those contracts, and it'll be business as usual for some of the contractors, and I could name off some that go from year to year to year that never meet their contract goals but still continue to get contract with the state of Minnesota, you know, and a governmental agency. So, you know, I'm thrilled to have Ms. Higgins here, Senator Higgins, get me here to testify. So you have an opportunity to do something, you know, with this bill to, you know, that ensure people from the inner city, You know, one thing about the building trades, they don't care if you got a criminal background or not. You know, you can apply, you get hired, they do not care if you got a criminal background. You know, they just want someone that's going to show up in the morning at 7 o'clock, work every day on time, give them a good 7.5-8 hours a day working, and you have a job. So, you know, I'm open to questions if anyone has any questions.
Are there questions for Senator Higgins or other witnesses? Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Higgins, is there anything at all in state law preventing local units of government from going forward with doing an ordinance like this now, or why do we need this legislation other than to make a point or encourage, but do we need the cities? Can't they already do this?
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I think defer to Mr. McGowan. I'm not an attorney, but I suspect
Mr. McGowan, do you have information that could help us here?
Madam Chair, Senator Gerlach, it's unclear whether public bodies can do this without this authority. The general rule is that local units of government can't do anything unless there's implied or specific authority to do so, and there is no specific authority in law to do this, but it's just comfort language to ensure that if these bodies want to do it, they may. It's totally optional, by the way. It doesn't require anybody to do anything.
Okay, thank you.
Is there further discussion? Senator Day.
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, would this mean like the present University of Minnesota stadium that's being built by the University of Minnesota, or I guess by us too? Does this mean that they, whatever workforce they have right now building their stadium or whatever it is, I voted against it, by the way, so don't. They would now have to what? They would have to eliminate some people from working there because they had to have a certain amount of people that had just gotten out of prison, and they would have to eliminate some people if they didn't have the right balance of diversity.
Madam Chair and
Senator Higgins.
Senator Day, it's interesting that you ask about the University of Minnesota project because I was speaking this morning with President Brunix, and he was saying that they had a goal of about 20% women and minority-owned contractor goals for the stadium project, and they are about 31%. So they have exceeded their goals, actually. What this would say would be that if the university chooses to, in the contracts with their contractors, they would set requirements for that contractor to meet goals. And it is not a mandatory thing, as Mr. McGowan says. It allows the university, if it would choose to set the goals, monitor them, and if they aren't being met, then to with they could choose not to do business with that contractor again, and it would be at their discretion to do. But the university project's actually meeting its goals, unlike other projects around. And the president, I think the president really gets this issue. He understands how important it is to have people working on projects at the University of Minnesota that reflect the makeup of the state of Minnesota.
So, Madam Chairman, so
Senator
he could direct the University of Minnesota on any project, or anybody on any city or county could direct whoever is doing work for them that this is the balance of what we want as your employees to work.
Would be a term of that contract.
Senator Higgins.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Been here for a couple of months, and I'm still not in the mode. But it would be something they could put in their term of the contract, that they would want the makeup of the work crew.
Madam Chair, all I would say is that, as Senator Higgins would probably realize, that wouldn't fit my mode of operation at all. I think you got to be colorblind when you're going to go out and build a building, and I can't imagine you hire whoever you can get there that can do the job, and who's ever available. And if somebody has to say, okay, well, I have to take somebody that just got out of prison, or I have to take somebody of color when they're maybe not somebody there that could do the job that was of color, I just that doesn't fit into my. I'll be voting no. That just doesn't fit into
Senator
my makeup
Day,
at all.
The legislation does not reflect requirement for race, just simply low income persons or former.
Right.
Former offenders. Senator Roebling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I noticed that it does give a definition for former offender, someone who's been discharged in the last 5 years or is currently on probation, parole, conditional release, or supervised release, but it doesn't give a definition for low income. And I guess, you know, if I were unemployed, I would be low income. How are you describing low income?
Go ahead.
Senator Roebling, if you look in the language at 111, it allows the hiring entity to define low income if they choose. I mean, they can say it's, you know, 100% of federal poverty, but the legislation doesn't require them, doesn't impose a low income definition. It allows the entity doing the hiring to indicate what they would define as low income.
Well, Madam Chair, and Senator Higgins, if I were on unemployment and receiving unemployment compensation, I wouldn't be at a poverty level. Not if I were like in a construction job and I could be making the highest level of unemployment benefits, which many construction workers do. And I think that's about $600 a week, maybe. And so I don't think that they would be considered below poverty level at that. So would we have to look for someone else that would be, I mean, it, to me, it, you know, I don't know. I have a problem with this. So the last bill was more about giving an opportunity, but this one is more about quotas. And I'm not supportive of quotas. I am supportive of opportunities. But I think that people have to be well qualified for positions, and you know, the best qualified people typically should be able to get the jobs, and not people who just have to meet quotas. I have a problem with this.
Senator Higgins?
I think both of my testifiers would like to respond.
I'd just like to respond to the quota thing. I mean, I don't consider this a quota. I consider this as an opportunity for people that's been deprived, economically deprived of opportunities to work in the building and construction trades. So I don't see it as being a quota. There's people that's been left out for many, many, many years on hundreds and hundreds of jobs here in this city and in this state simply because of who they are, and what color they are, or what gender they are. And I think it's time that people get included. You know, just because you don't have the skills, I mean, I get folks all the time that don't have any skills to get into building construction trades. I get a contractor to hire that individual, bring them on board, pay their union dues initiation fee, buy them tools. They start out as a first-year apprentice. They work from first-year apprentice all the way up to becoming a journey worker. Got a minority female that was making $7 an hour 6 years ago. Today, she's a journeyman sheet metal worker making almost 30 bucks an hour. So it's not a matter of a quote. It's a matter of, I think, what's right, you know, to give people an opportunity to have access to high-paying, good-paying construction and building trade jobs.
Madam Chair, I was just, I think this is about opportunity. We want to compete right now. We have no government contracts. We're competing all with private employers. And I would give two specific examples in terms of government purchasing practices and how a targeted strategy like this could provide opportunities and expand the marketplace. One is in, let's look at garbage hauling. Every public entity hires garbage haulers. Those garbage haulers usually hire temp laborers to support, sort the recycling materials or whatever. Right there, just by having us compete on price and performance for those recycling jobs is one opportunity that this ordinance could open up. Most garbage haulers say they have national temp contracts, and they can't work with anybody else in the community. an ordinance like this could help at least give us the opportunity to compete on price and performance. A second is on a lot of road projects, at least, again, for our entry-level kind of workers. They hire temp workers to lay sod, plant trees, clean up after the job. That, again, I just want an opportunity to compete on price and performance against the standard routine that people usually go to the same old sources for labor like ours. So those are two examples where I think an ordinance like this, if an entity chooses us to adopt it, would benefit us and give us an opportunity to compete on price and performance.
Are there any other questions or comments for Senator Higgins? Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to speak either in support or in opposition to this bill? Senator Pappas?
Seeing none, Madam Chair, then I would move that Senate File 536 as amended be recommended to pass.
And refer to the Committee on Judiciary.
Okay.
Yes, they requested it.
Oh, they did.
Senator Higgins, the reason for that is that your bill is greatly expanded from the one that was introduced, including former offenders. Prior to that, the bill had not been requested. Senator Pappas, it's your decision, but after it goes to judiciary, since two of the major sections in the bill now deal with higher education, you may want to see it there as well. Senator Pappas moves that Senate File 536 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Judiciary. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails, and the bill will be sent to the Committee on Judiciary.
Thank you all very much.
The next two bills are one's for Senator Scheid, who is unable to be here today. I'm a co-author on the bill, and I'll be doing the bills for her.
Sometimes the government's all right.
The subcommittee, and then you should need to move adoption.
Mr. Chair.
File 423, which has been heard in the election subcommittee. Senator Sieben.
I move the subcommittee report, please.
Moves the subcommittee report on Senate File 423. All those in favor, aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Rest, Senate
Thank you,
File
Bob.
423.
Mr. Chair, members, Senate File 423 became an issue last year during the campaign when a House candidate ran into a problem whereby the law allowed for payment for food and beverages and entertainment to be counted as a non-campaign expense, but did not allow the paper cups and plates and so forth to be counted as a non-campaign expense. And because it was a very competitive campaign, as I understand, and that got to be an issue, whether the paper plates had to be counted as a campaign expense. And Mr. Goldsmith of the Campaign Finance Board testified in the subcommittee that they would welcome this clarification and this new language. The subcommittee adopted the language without amendment. And, Mr. Chairman, I would ask the members in looking at that language to consider putting it on the consent calendar.
Thank you, Senator Rust. Any questions? All right.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that Senate File 423 be recommended to pass and be placed on the consent calendar.
Senator Rust moves Senate File 423 be recommended to pass and placed on the consent calendar. All those in favor, aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Senate File 32, which was also heard in the subcommittee, Senator Sieben.
I'd move that subcommittee report to Mr. Chair.
Senator Sieben moves the subcommittee report on Senate File 32 be adopted. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, again, in the last election, a election judge came forward to Senator Scheid and expressed a reluctance in taking the oath as an election judge to use the word swear based on religious convictions. Elsewhere in the statute, there's references to affirm or swear means exactly the same thing as pertains to the results of making the statement. And so Senator Scheid is simply asking that in the actual language of the oath that is taken, that on line 1-9, that the person be able to say, "I solemnly affirm." That permission, again, is given in other sections of the statute in, I'm not sure what the statute number is, but there is a definition of oath, affirmation, affirm, sworn. That oath includes affirmation in all cases where by law an affirmation may be substituted for an oath. And in like cases, swear includes affirm and sworn includes affirmed. This just makes it clear in the language that is presented to the election judge that he or she may say, "I, Ann Rest, solemnly affirm."
Thank you. Any questions of members? Anyone care to testify either in favor or in opposition? Seeing none.
Mr. Chairman, I would also suggest that this is a candidate for the consent calendar.
Senator Rest moves that Senate File 32 be recommended to pass and placed on the consent agenda. All those in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On behalf of Senator Rest. Senator Prettner-Solon, welcome to the committee. Senator Prettner-Solon brings us Senate File 444. Senator Prettner-Solon.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm hoping you didn't have to wait too long for me.
We didn't have to wait at all.
I appreciate the opportunity to present this bill to you. This bill is before you because Section 1, Subdivision 3, allows the Commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency to adopt rules to build this greenhouse gas emissions registry. This bill was passed out of the Energy Committee with unanimous support. It is currently supported by the environmentalists, the business community, and the PCA. This bill instructs the MPCA to establish a system for reporting and maintaining information to help us support strategies to achieve the state's greenhouse gas reduction goals. I'm still out of breath from running up the stairs.
Okay, take your time.
The language in the bill clarifies the rulemaking authority of the PCA, addresses the issues of establishing reporting thresholds, and recognizes the role of data management technology in the development process. The absence of specific timelines also provides the PCA the flexibility to consider the federal role in establishing a reporting system. I will not go into any further details of the proposal or the reason for the legislation, but I'll stand for any questions that you might have on it. And the PCA Manager of Environmental Data Management, Frank Kolosch, is here to answer questions on the PCA's rulemaking experiences. PCA Commissioner David Thornton, I believe, is also here to answer questions as well.
Members, the reason that this bill comes to this committee is the last two lines in the bill that refer to rulemaking authority for the PCA. So that is what we will focus on here. If you have any other questions about the bill, I'm sure Senator Prettner-Solon can explain them, but our job is to examine the why the Pollution Control Agency should be given authority to adopt rules, what their experience has been in the past in adopting rules. Have their rules been accepted by the Office of Administrative Hearings? Have they been turned down? We'd like to know a little bit of history for the PCA and its rulemaking authority and why they need to do it now in this instance. Sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Frank Kolash. I am manager of the Air Assessment and Environmental Data Management section at the Pollution Control Agency. We have been working with Senator Bretner Solon on this bill, and we understand that the reporting of greenhouse gases, gas emissions, is important work for the tracking of trends and reductions provided for in the Next Generation Energy Act. We believe our authorizing statutes give us authority for the rulemaking contemplated by this bill. The rulemaking authority included in the bill will clarify our authority for rulemaking and be helpful to avoid any potential questions in any future rulemaking related to this bill, which and any future rulemaking will be guided by the terms of this bill and also future federal regulations. The PCA continues to work on the development of a greenhouse gas inventory and is actively participating in greenhouse gas reporting protocol efforts throughout the country. There are specific questions regarding the nature of PCA rulemaking. Would you like me to answer those at this time?
Yeah, just give us a little bit of history about when you have proposed rules. Have they been rejected? Have they? What's your record on on rulemaking with the Office of Administrative Hearings? Have you done it in a timely fashion? Just give us some general history about your record. It's almost like doing a little bit of an audit here of your record in rulemaking.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Our general history in rulemaking is we have a number of different efforts that focus on rulemaking across a number of parts of the agency. I believe that we have a generally good record on performing rulemaking. I am not aware at this time of any specific rules that have been rejected in the recent past, regarding PCA rulemaking. We do have an active interagency group, and we work with other agencies to help us coordinate rulemaking. We keep track of that very closely. And while we attempt to perform our rulemaking in as expeditious of a manner as is possible, it is oftentimes hard to predict the exact amount of time and what's going to happen depending on the nature of the rule and the controversial nature of the rule. But in general, I believe that we are able to make expeditious and efficient process using our rulemaking processes and the knowledge of rulemaking and the knowledge of this subject matter at the agency.
Thank you, Mr. Koloff. We ask those questions because we have had you know, a little seminar from the Office of Administrative Hearings about the reasons why people's rules get rejected. A lot of it is timing, that they don't do it in a timely fashion. After they've been given authority to do them, they don't get them done, and it ends up wasting the time of the Office of Administrative Hearings, too, because they get rejected until the defect in the rule is corrected, and often it's a timing issue. So if you're given this authority, I hope that you will act in a way that gets the rules done, following the rules, as a matter of fact, for them. Are there questions or comments for Senator Bretner Solon or Mr. Kolash? Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was just looking at kind of the parameters here of how this reporting system would be set up, and it says it need not include all sources of emissions nor all amounts of emissions, but at its outset should attempt to include most, if not all, stationary sources of emissions above a specified level. And I'm wondering, for example, is a barn full of cattle a stationary source, And what level would you imagine their emissions would be at? And would that be something you would have to include in your report?
Senator Prettner-Solance, a little bit far afield from authority, but I did invite members to ask questions about the substance of the bill, although our jurisdiction is only the rulemaking.
Right. And Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, this arises out of our passage of the Next Generation Energy Act of 2007, in which we set goals where three benchmarks that we would meet until ultimately by 2050, we would reduce our greenhouse gas emissions by 80%. But in order to know if we're reducing them, we need to know what kind of greenhouse gases are being emitted. And I think that we had actually set a fairly liberal level, and I don't know if you mean maybe conservative is what you want to hear, a level that was pretty reasonable, not extreme. And I can't remember what that was, but it was... So stationary actually refers to the fact that it's not moving. I'm assuming that animals wouldn't be included then, or vehicles wouldn't be included. The gas pumps would be included. Industry would be included. Factories would be included.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
And, you know, some cattle aren't roaming much, but and I do have concern about it because it's a big issue in the farming community right now because of some proposed federal rules that they've been looking at. And cows give off a lot of greenhouse gases, apparently, and they would like to regulate or tax them for their emissions. And so I'm just wondering where we're going with this because it's a concern in the rural areas.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, as I said, we're trying to get a base level at a fairly high level, actually. And we realize that we could be preempted by federal law at any time. But we are trying to begin to get an inventory of what our greenhouse gas emissions are from the most easily measured sources of greenhouse gas emissions.
Any other questions for Senator Prettner-Solon? Seeing none, Senator Lori moves that Senate File 444 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Right. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Thank you very much, Senator Prettner-Solon. Senator Moore. Senator Moore brings us two bills that were heard in the election subcommittee. Senator Sieben moves adoption of the subcommittee report. Senator Moore, which bill would you like to take first?
564, please, Madam Chair.
Senator Sieben moves adoption of the subcommittee report on Senate File 564. Senator Moore.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for an opportunity to present to you Senate File 564. Senate File 564 is an avenue to address the voting rights of individuals who have been incarcerated. The gist of the bill is to restore individuals' voting rights upon their release from incarceration. The bill, as before you, was there's a...
Senator Moore, apparently we had the motion, but we didn't vote on it. All those in favor of Senator Sieben's motion to adopt the subcommittee report, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The report is adopted. Excuse me.
Madam Chair and members, in the subcommittee, we put on the A2 delete everything amendment, which is, I believe, the bill. And so I think you have in front of you the A2 amendment. This bill does three things. It restores voting rights to people convicted of a felony at the point they are released from incarceration or placed on probation or parole instead of at the end of the felony sentence. It requires notice about voting rights to be provided before a plea is accepted at the point a person's voting rights are restored. And it requires the Secretary of State to publicize information about these changes to judges, corrections officials, elections officials, and the public. Section 1 of the bill changes the definition of restoration of civil rights so that people with felony convictions are eligible to vote after completing the term of incarceration for an offense. Voting rights are restored at the time a person is discharged from a correctional facility or at the time a person is placed on probation, parole, conditional release, or supervised release in an instance where the individual is not necessarily ending up in a correctional facility. This would grandfather in people who are currently under current law not eligible to vote because they are on probation or parole, conditional release, or supervised release. Section 2 is a technical change to the voter registration card with reference to the changes in Section 1. Section 3 is a technical change to reflect the changes made in Section 1. Section 4 requires the Secretary of State to prepare materials explaining the new law and to send those materials to state courts and Department of Corrections to be distributed. The Secretary of State, it also asks that the Secretary of State makes the information available to the public. In the subcommittee, although today the Secretary of State's office is not here because we've asked them to come, but they can't be here. Beth Frazier is out. I think she's sick. But they testified in the committee that they do this and that it would not be extra onerous for them to assist in this section. Section 5 of the amendment is a technical change to the Voter's Bill of Rights to reflect the changes in Section 1. Section 6 is a technical change to the notice statement on the voting rosters that are currently in use. Section 7 establishes a process for people to be notified when their voting rights are restored. So Subdivision 1 requires correctional facilities to designate a person to provide the notice required in this bill. Subdivision 2 requires the correction officials to give notice to people who have lost their voting rights at the time their rights are restored. Subdivision 3 has specific language that should be used in the notification process. And Subdivision 1 clarifies that if a person does not receive the notice required in this section, their right to vote is still restored. Section 8 clarifies that the changes made in Section 1 apply specifically to voting rights. Section 9 requires courts to notify a defendant before accepting a guilty plea that the person will lose voting rights for the time they're incarcerated if they are convicted. This would be the informed plea section of the bill. Madam Chair, members, this is Senate File 564.
Thank you, Senator Mua. We had extensive testimony on this bill in the subcommittee. And I know that not everyone on the committee, obviously, is on the subcommittee. I see that some of the same witnesses are here. If you have any questions about any section of the bill, for them to answer, but I don't think we need them to repeat their testimony. Are there questions or comments for Senator Mua on Senate File 564? Senator Gimsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was on the subcommittee, but I have a couple of questions. Is there ever a time when somebody is convicted of a felony but not sentenced to incarceration?
The reason why the bill is drafted the way it is that there would be instances where an individual would not be sentenced to incarceration. And so the bill is that your voting rights are restricted only when you are incarcerated.
So if someone is convicted of a felony but given only probation, they would not lose their right to vote. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Senator Gimsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, that wasn't clear to me in subcommittee that and kind of gives me another look at it that I guess I didn't realize that the extent to which this bill revisits the rights of convicted felons. It's from the very point of sentencing, if they're not convicted to incarceration, and also from the point that they are released from incarceration. So,
okay, thank you, Senator Gimsey. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, as state and local officials continue to have budget problems and may start to look at other forms of holding people accountable who have committed crimes, and some of it is already done. For example, the house arrests when you have to wear a bracelet to make sure that people are not moving about the community, that they're confined to their homes, a kind of a house arrest system. But it would be my understanding that that would not qualify, that they'd actually have to be in a prison or a jail in order to have their voting right revoked, because if they're under house arrest, they could still go vote or get an absentee ballot or whatever it might be. What's your interpretation of that?
Senator Moore.
Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, the bill, as presented to you, will restrict only the rights to vote of individuals who are incarcerated in our correctional facilities. Madam Chair and members, Professor Chris Eugen from the University of Minnesota has passed out a presentation that he made to the subcommittee. And for the purpose of the full committee's consideration, I'd like to draw your attention to slide number 8. On the second page, that looks at other states across the United States that have looked at similar changes. If you look at that page, there are 2 states that have no restrictions on voting rights. There are 14 states plus Washington, D.C. that restricts inmates only. I'd like to draw your attention that in that category of states are North Dakota and South Dakota and Indiana and Illinois. And then we are in the 2 categories down where we restrict inmates, parolees, and probationers. And where we are looking to move to would be to be included in the inmates-only category among our neighbors.
Are there any other questions or comments for Senator Mua or her witnesses? Senator Lurie? Senator Lurie moves that Senate File 564, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Judiciary. All those in favor of that motion? Senator Day, first.
Madam Chair, I think I'll just talk to the group here. He said, so what we're saying, even though we have the least amount of incarcerated people in the country, we're probably 48th, the state 50th, we have been for years and years. So what we're saying is that if you have a felony and you don't get incarcerated, you can go vote. Voting is a privilege. Isn't it about time? I mean, come on. We already went through getting a job. We went through all these things. And now what we're saying also is that, whoa, wait a minute. We should be able to, if you have a 7-year felony charge and we're good enough to let you out in 3 years, that you can go vote in 3 years. And I'm saying, whoa, wait a minute. Why do we want to do that? Why do we want to do that? I don't get that. I've been listening here now for about 2-3 hours, and it seems like people that commit crimes are almost better off in just about every area that the bills that we brought in all day here. And it's got to be aggravating to somebody here besides me, but maybe not. So if voting is a great privilege in the United States, and somebody commits a felony and they say, we're going to give you 7 years, and you get out in 3 years because we say, hey, we need the space, we need whatever, whatever. Why do we instantly want to say then, okay, now you can go vote too? We took that privilege away for a reason.
Senator Day, I would direct your attention to another one of these slides, the one right next to, I don't know, it doesn't have a number on it, but the one right next to number 8, to which Senator Moore referred. And apparently when following incarceration, when ex-felons are at least for that part of their, that they've served their sentence, those that regain the franchise at that point have a much lower recidivism rate because they're welcome back. Let me just look at the data. They're welcome back into the community, and they start to become participating citizens, including voting. And the judgment that you and I and others have to make is whether that is a value that we want to promote. And it's perfectly clear that people can come to a different decision about whether that is the way to go, and that restoring the right to vote, is it a good enough reason, at least one reason, to have a significant impact on people not returning to prison because they've become members of the community?
And Madam Chair, all I would say is that we in Minnesota go way past the extra mile before we will actually lock people up and give them a felony. We're wonderful people. We're not mean-spirited. We are very, and yet, I mean, it's almost like someday somebody's going to come here with a bill and say you don't send anybody to even prison in Minnesota, and you give a, you know, you can put a lot of charts together and do a lot of things, but I just, I don't know, I...
Other comments? And again, the bill received extensive hearing in the subcommittee. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do have some concerns about the bill. You know, people who are on probation and still under the court's jurisdiction can now go and vote for judges. They can vote for county attorneys. They can vote for sheriffs, all of whom are still possibly overseeing part of their probation or parole period. And I'm not sure I'm comfortable with that. In fact, I know I'm not comfortable with that. I would rather have them completely discharged of their sentence before they can come in and vote for positions that have oversight over the conditions of their release. And I think that should be a concern to everybody.
Are there further comments? Senator Gimsey.
Madam Chair, I'd request a roll call.
Certainly. A roll call has been requested. Senator Lori moves that Senate File 564, as amended, be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Judiciary. The clerk will take the roll.
Senator Rest?
Yes.
Senator Betzel?
Yes.
Senator Carlson?
Yes.
Senator Day?
No.
Senator Gerlach?
No.
Senator Gimsey?
No.
Senator Lori?
Yes.
Senator Marty?
Yep.
Senator Olsen?
Yes.
Senator Pappas?
Yes.
Senator Roebling?
No.
Senator Sieben?
Yes.
Senator Vickerman?
Yes.
There being 9 ayes and 4 nays, the motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Moore and gentlemen. And next we move on to Senate File 763.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The
Senator
Senate
Sieben moves adoption of the subcommittee report. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails, and the subcommittee report is now before us. Senator Moore.
Madam Chair members, Senate File 763 takes the current law as we have it, which restricts inmates, parolees, and probationers. So it takes the current law as we have it, but it imposes upon the current law the same notice requirement that we have in Senate File 564, and it also includes new language to provide for the informed plea section of the law. It adds a new language for the informed plea. So that's the bill.
Are there questions or comments on Senate File 763? This is about giving notice of about information, and only that. It's not about the rights issues. Any questions, comments? Senator Lori? Senator Lori moves that Senate File 763, as amended, be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Judiciary. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No.
Speak up with your nose. No. The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Senator Mua and members. Next, we have Senate File 549, Senator Dibble. Senator Dibble brings us the third engrossment of greenhouse gas reduction goals and strategies, and the jurisdictional issue that brings the bill to this committee is that he imposes there's some local government requirements imposed. Senator Dibble, would you like to point out where you impose requirements on local governments?
Yes, Madam Chair. By local governments, do you also include
Metropolitan
schools?
Council.
School districts? There's a school district piece as well.
It also includes school districts, okay. Senator Dibble, but the bill, if it's acted on favorably here, does have to go to the Education
yes,
Committee.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Yes. So we don't need to bring up the school district issues.
Okay.
We can just the others, if you
okay.
don't mind.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Just very, very quickly and in terms of high-level summary overview, I'll just give it 30 seconds if I can manage that. What this bill seeks to do generally is to try to create the intersection, the connection between our land use and transportation and global warming carbon dioxide emission reduction policies and strategies. And it seeks to do that, Madam Chair, by recognizing the recommendation of the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group's one of their recommended actions to take a look at our land use policies and seek to amend those so that we create more opportunities for fewer vehicle miles to be traveled. That creates greater opportunities for transit, for walking, for pedestrians, or for people to drive shorter distances to the places where they need to go throughout the metropolitan area specifically. It does allow for voluntary activity on the part of municipalities in greater Minnesota to undertake these activities and provide some grants to that purpose. It establishes a vehicle miles traveled reduction goal for the Metropolitan Council and directs them to adopt that goal within their systems planning and policy statements as a part of the overall authority that they have to direct comprehensive land use planning at the municipal level throughout the metropolitan area. And it then seeks, of course, to have local comprehensive plans conform to those system policy statements, as is the case today. It engages the University of Minnesota to undertake a fairly substantive program to develop a lot of the policies and the modeling tools to do some original research, but also work collaboratively and cooperatively with the Metropolitan Council and local units of government. I'm sorry, and that's spelled out in the A4 amendment. More specifically, so we'll have to move that at some point. And then.
Sorry.
Oh.
I was just going to say I'll move it whenever you'd like
okay.
it moved.
Provides as well for the University of Minnesota to do some training and some technical consultation with local units of government. Provides grants to local units of government. As well in the metropolitan area to do the work that they need to do to update their comprehensive plans. It also, in the A4 amendments, right now, the whole comprehensive planning process is based on census data that, and as a matter of fact, right now the comprehensive plans are being turned into the Metropolitan Council based on census data that's pretty old. And so it seeks to do all of that work sooner within the decade so that the development that's occurred, the populations that we're dealing with, et cetera, are more recent. Let me see if I missed anything, Madam Chair, that would be of interest to the committee. Oh, and also, Madam Chair, the Livable Communities Fund criteria. Folks are probably very familiar with the Livable Communities Fund. Provides communities with a match for certain kinds of development, compact, mixed use, et cetera. It also rolls in the vehicle miles traveled and greenhouse gas reduction priorities as a criteria to be considered when communities are applying for those competitive funds.
Senator Gibbelina, I will accept a motion from Senator Pappas to adopt the A4 amendment, but you know, I'm uncomfortable with it because it seems to me that it's, I need to hear some justification about why this particular amendment, and particularly dealing with the University of Minnesota Center for Transportation Studies, and a big part of it is under the jurisdiction of this committee, because I don't believe it is. You want to make a case for why we should adopt this amendment in this committee? I'm not saying it's a bad amendment, but that why it's appropriate here rather than in the Education Committee?
Madam Chair, a good portion of the amendment deals with it replaces Section 9 as well as Section 11, which has to do with adopting the vehicle miles travel reduction goal and updating the system policy statements, as well as giving, changing some dates for the local comprehensive plan conformance.
In Section 9, though, the council that is being talked about is the Metropolitan Council. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's not Section 9 mm-hmm. that I think is not in our jurisdiction. It's Sections 15. It's Section 15.
Okay.
Senator Dibble, would you mind if we separated those two and you take up the Section 15 in the Education Committee? Or higher ed, or wherever it goes within the.
Right. The other than Madam Chair, this does set forth a fairly specific set of activities that the University of Minnesota is going to engage in with local communities and the Metropolitan Council for the purpose of developing the policy, develop the clearinghouse of policies and techniques and tools. They're going to be working with the local units as well to conduct training. That's Subdivision 2, and then in Subdivision 3, provide the technical assistance to the local units of government, the Metropolitan Council, as they work to update
maybe
their comprehensive
plans. Maybe, Senator Dibowitz, I was startled by the head note more than by
transfer
whether the jurisdiction is correct.
Yeah,
and maybe the jurisdiction is correct for that amendment, since it is directing Met Council to do certain things.
In conjunction with the University of Minnesota, Madam Chair.
Does anybody else want to raise a question with the jurisdictional issues in that amendment?
That's fine.
Seeing none. Senator Pappas.
Oh, Madam Chair.
Yes?
I do need to change on line 119, where it refers to Section 12 at the end of the line. That should read Section 15.
13?
15.
15.
Yeah. We're not doing 15.
Senator Pappas will incorporate in her motion to adopt the A4 amendment on line 119, strike 12, insert 15. Senator Dibble, then would you go through the A4 amendment a little bit more extensively?
Sure, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, what the A4 amendment calls for is for the Metropolitan Council to create a policy supporting a reduction in vehicle miles traveled, and it gives an index reduced by 17% by from 2005 levels by 2025, and that's recognized as what we would need to achieve in order to start to get a handle on the contributions that transportation makes towards our greenhouse gas emission, which is about 24% of the total. Electrical energy sector is about 35%, transportation is about 24%. Most of that is from private passenger vehicles. And refers, of course, to the Climate Change Advisory Group's reports of the legislature. And asks as they develop policies, et cetera, and do the analysis that they work with the University of Minnesota.
And
then it calls for the Metropolitan Council to revise their development guide and their system plans to be consistent with that policy goal, and that's something that the Council does every 10 years And those are the kind of the policy statements, system goals for transit, for land use, for sewers, et cetera. And then, of course, the guidelines for comprehensive planning that's done at the local level would need to be updated, and that's done in conjunction in the work with the University of Minnesota that we referenced earlier. And then it asks, then it just clarifies this estimate of the 2005 vehicle miles traveled, the index against which we're pegging this reduction, just makes clear that this is not for traffic that's traveling through a particular jurisdiction. That was a concern of the local units of government, but rather that which is originating within that jurisdiction from their residential base. And then it goes on to conform the the updates to the comprehensive planning that's done at the local level by certain dates, for their update that they do every 10 years, which they're doing right now, but in the coming decade would land in the middle of the decade rather than towards the end. And then the final piece of the amendment, Madam Chair, is the work of the University of Minnesota that I described, and then providing for some grants for the local units of government in the metropolitan area, as well as some grants on a voluntary basis for the governments in greater Minnesota that want to undertake this activity.
Are there questions or comments for Senator Dibble on the A4 amendment? Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dibble, I assume there's been conversations with the Center for Transportation Studies about this project.
Senator Dibble.
Yes, Madam Chair, very much so. As a matter of fact, this whole concept was developed in collaboration with the Center for Transportation Studies.
Great, thanks.
Are there further questions on the A4 amendment? Senator Gerlach.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I have a few questions for Senator Dibble. The first one is on Section 15, on the transfer of money, the Metropolitan Livable Communities Fund, that's the source of funding for this.
It's on page 4, members.
Page 4, Section 15. The Livable Communities Fund, the Met Council, is used to fund all the various aspects of this. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the money that goes into the Livable Communities Fund comes from fiscal disparities, doesn't it?
Ben, sure, maybe you know.
No.
Am I not right?
The taxes.
Madam Chair, it's a levy that the Metropolitan Council levies against property taxes region-wide.
There are some dollars in the Livable Communities Fund that come out of fiscal disparities, Senator Dibble. Representative Long made sure that happened
but it's
very minor.
Okay, but it's property tax dollars.
Yes.
It's a levy, yes.
Yeah, it's a levy, so it's levy. Property
That's
tax
correct.
Dollars.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, Senator Dibble, my question is this, I guess, is I'm not so sure it might be an easy source of funds for this, but it looks like you're trying to tackle a large issue that goes beyond the metropolitan area, beyond the state, and it's you would argue global, but yet we're putting it on really on the backs of property taxpayers, and why I guess in one particular area. So just within the metropolitan area, there are more cars in the metropolitan area, yes, but a vehicle mile traveled in my district is going to cause the same amount of greenhouse gases as a car driven in Carrick. That's why I asked you what city you were from. and yet it's my property taxpayers that are being asked to pony up the money for this program. And it's probably a very, very easy vote for folks who live outside that area that have no skin in the game. So why isn't this a general fund appropriation, other than, of course, the question of the deficit situation? But why is this being funded with property tax dollars? It just seems like a very inappropriate funding source to be looking at this with property tax dollars.
Senator Dibble?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two quick answers. First of all, Senator Gerlach, if you look at Subdivision 5, that's for grants to communities in greater Minnesota. The source identified is the Metropolitan Livable Communities Fund. That will change. That that will not be the source for those grants.
I'm sorry, that is
an error that needs to be remedied.
Wait, is this in the amendment?
What are you talking about?
It's in the amendment.
In the amendment,
yeah,
page 5 of
page
the amendment?
Page 5, 5.18 to 5.20.
That says...
Yeah. However, the remainder of the bill and the focus of the bill and everything that we're talking about is specific to the metropolitan area.
So, Senator Dibble, do you want to remove that?
We can do that. I don't know what source, if we're going to come up with any, because, of course, we don't have general fund.
Right.
But we can certainly...
It would certainly make that clear.
Yeah.
Senator Pappas will include that in her motion. We have not yet voted on it. So included in the motion to adopt this amendment is to delete lines 518 through 520.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, did you want to delete the whole thing or just delete from the Metropolitan Livable Communities Fund?
Yeah, Madam Chair, if we could just say from the general fund, maybe for now.
Ah, I see. Mm-hmm. Thank you for the clarification. So on line 19, strike Metropolitan Livable Communities and insert general. Senator Pappas, is that what you want? Okay, that.
Madam Chair, do we say from the general fund or do we just say is appropriated?
Mr. McGowan?
Madam Chair, I think we still say general fund.
Okay.
Okay. Senator Gerlach, continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dibble, let me ask it this way here. If the goal of the bill is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, who is the beneficiary of that if this is all successful? Who benefits from this bill? Let's start there.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We all do.
Okay, Madam Chair, so we all, meaning all the state legislature, so all the citizens of Minnesota benefit. But again, we're funding the efforts being done through the Center of Transportation Studies, through here and the various other, all these pieces here. We're funding something that benefits the state of Minnesota through the Livable Communities Fund, which comes from a very narrow group of property taxpayers. What I'm saying is I don't believe that that's an appropriate source of funds. I think that if you want to argue the case, since we all benefit, that this entire bill should come from the general fund. Can you tell me where I'm wrong on that assessment?
Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, reduction of greenhouse gas emissions is one of the goals of this bill. But there are many co-benefits as well to this bill. One of them is more efficient development of land in the metropolitan area, and that has a very specific local benefit to our property taxes and the amount of effort that we need to expend to develop infrastructure to serve, you know, development and redevelopment throughout the metropolitan area will be far more efficient. We'll end up saving a lot of money if we're not, you know, building all kinds of roads and parking lots and sewer systems. We're creating, more and greater opportunities to use land in many ways. We'll do mixed-use development, and we'll be locating, employment centers near where we live and near where we shop and go to school, et cetera. So there's definitely a local benefit that can be construed. Additionally, the whole premise of the Livable Communities Fund is to create, encourage, incent kinds of development that describes as well. So it's a very consistent use of the Livable Communities Fund. And lately, actually, there's been a little bit of a surplus in the Livable Communities Fund. There, the matching requests haven't come in. And so there's some capacity within the Livable Communities Fund. And I should add that this does not imply an increase to the Livable Communities Fund levy. This uses the existing resources.
And, Senator Dibble, I think I misspoke about the relationship of Livable Communities and fiscal disparities. I don't think it quite operates that way, but there were other funds in I'm going to have to go and look that up. But there's a relationship between livable communities and fiscal disparities, but I don't think it's quite as simple as I was indicating.
Okay.
But I'm going to look it up.
I can imagine, Madam Chair, that there's implications for the contributions that a local jurisdiction makes to fiscal disparities based on the commercial development that results from some of these developments.
I'm sure there's somebody here from the city that can tell us where those dollars come from. Senator Gerlach, did you have more questions on the amendment? Because we do want to take a vote on it so we can get to the testimony and move on.
No, I don't have any more questions, Madam Chair. I just have a problem. Property tax dollars are a very sensitive issue. And we use them in livable communities. We use them for matching programs or housing issues and things like that. But it seems to me like we're now, because we have a general fund deficit, we're looking for other places of money to do things we want to do. And that I just look at it as a bleed off, for studies and things like that that aren't concrete. If we're going to study, for a general benefit, it should be general fund. And I don't like the idea of using the property tax dollars in this way.
I think that, the issue for us is what is the purpose of the livable communities levy, and is this is the purpose fulfilled in the program that he has, given that he's proposing here, given that it is a property tax issue. But I think we all understand the amendment now. All those in favor of Senator Pappas's motion to amend Senate File 549 with the A4 amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Let's move on to the testifiers, directing them to speak solely to the local government issues and nothing else.
Madam Chair, we have Jay Drake Hamilton with us from Fresh Energy, who can help us out, and we can limit testimony for time.
Ms. Hamilton, please talk about the not about the environmental issues, but about the local government issues.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thanks for taking my testimony, and thanks to Senator Dibble. By way of introduction, I'm Jay Drake Hamilton. I'm with Fresh Energy, which has existed since 1990, was incorporated as a nonprofit to support policy actions to lead Minnesota to a clean, fair, and efficient energy system. And as part of that work, I direct our Global Warming Solutions Program. I was appointed by Governor Pawlenty in the spring of 2007 to serve on his climate change advisory group. And part of the reason I agreed to serve was that he identified the purpose of the climate change advisory group, quote, to identify, evaluate, and recommend to me and the legislature a range of actions that, consistent with the state's need for economic vitality, will substantially reduce Minnesota's greenhouse gas emissions. I was one of 56 members of that group. Local government was also represented on that group. Senator Prettner-Solon already alluded during testimony on a previous bill that the goal is 30% reductions by 2025 across the state's economy. So in other words, we need to take our emissions down from about 157 million metric tons by about 30%. So the Climate Change Advisory Group recommended that we need to make sure that Minnesotans have more attractive options for getting around. And we recommended a suite of measures that, taken together and enacted properly, would reduce vehicle miles traveled. They include improved land use planning and development strategies, expanding transit, bicycle, and pedestrian infrastructure, workplace tools that would encourage carpooling, transit ridership, and bicycling. All of those recommendations had unanimous support from the Climate Change Advisory Group, and all of them would achieve carbon reductions at net savings to large net savings. So Fresh Energy
Hamilton,
supports.
How are local governments to be involved in that effort? That's what we want to hear.
Madam Chair, the goals that were set by the Next Generation Energy Act apply across the state's economy. And so global warming emissions come from all sectors of the economy. And so the responsible take we think on this is that we look at what are the cheapest ways to get reductions. And what the MCAG found was one of the greatest benefits to Minnesota would be providing more attractive options for people for getting around other than driving alone in their cars.
I think, I'm looking at the summary. I'm thinking more of things like Section 3, where the local units of government are given authority to make changes in their municipal ordinances. I mean, that's the impact that local governments will have on this policy that I think our attention needs to be drawn to.
Madam Chair, We have John Bailey who could speak a little bit more specifically to that, but I think you just hit the nail on the head. It has to do with land use planning in ways that fulfill that goal of reducing vehicle miles traveled, and that comes about through a whole suite of policies.
That allows local governments to be involved in making those decisions
exactly.
Through ordinances. At least that's how I read Section 3 that's of interest to this committee. But Mr. Bailey, thank you, Ms. Hamilton.
Good afternoon or good evening, Madam Chair. My name is John Bailey. I'm with Thousand Friends of Minnesota. We're a statewide membership organization promoting better ways to grow in communities all around the state. I also just wanted to quickly note that this initiative is a part of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership, one of their priority issues. MEP is an organization of over 80 environmental organizations representing over 450,000 Minnesotans. I'll skip my testimony, just go right to the question, especially about how this affects local units of government and the municipal ordinance changes. With an example of what we do at Thousand Friends of Minnesota, where about 70% of our resources are spent on technical assistance and resource sharing with mainly small ex-urban communities around the metropolitan area that are really looking for resources to make these kind of changes, that are kind of realizing they have changing demographics, changing consumer preferences, and want to make these land use changes. And at Thousand Friends of Minnesota, we're able to support some of those initiatives and provide some resources, but it's very clear to us that as a statewide issue, we need to create that policy framework moving forward that deals with land use changes, transportation investments, that recognize the new realities of rising and erratic energy prices, climate change, and again, these changing demographics and shifting consumer preferences. So land use is certainly a local issue, but we think the state, through its investment powers, through its regulatory authority, has a clear part in this as well. So with that, I'll end my testimony.
Okay, are there any questions or comments for Mr. Bailey?
Madam Chair?
Senator Rolstein?
Well, I think page 8, line 9 kind of sums it up the best, or 8 and 9, where that metropolitan system statements to each local governmental unit that must prepare and submit local comprehensive plans to the council by July 20th. 13. I mean, that's a pretty big deal for
the Metropolitan Council, for the metropolitan area.
Right, for those local units of government.
Madam Chair.
I guess I have a question, and that is, what can you guys do to help them accomplish that task?
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple things. One is, we're engaging the University of Minnesota. To work at first for the first few years on a voluntary basis, those local units of government in the metropolitan area who want to engage with the University of Minnesota in developing, making sure that the modeling and the policy ideas and all the array of tools in the toolbox, we use that expression a lot, are available, are specific, are customized to the Twin Cities area as well. As then moving out and providing, providing and being a great resource for training on what's available. Basically, bringing folks in, running through the whole list of, how we can do this, how we can accomplish this, the benefits to the local community, et cetera. And then moving on from there, provide a great deal of technical assistance. That will take a lot of pressure off of local units of government trying to figure this out. This is actually not that complex or hard to do. Very consistent with a lot of the trends and a lot of what local units have been doing. Livable Communities Fund is a great example of that. But to the extent that locals either have to create capacity and competency on their own staff or hire very expensive consultants, this will help relieve a lot of that. Additionally, there's a grant program that's provided for in the language of the bill. Also, I should just add, the first incarnation of the bill asked that we update the current plans, so it created a whole new effort within the existing comprehensive planning process. This seeks to, doesn't do that anymore, but seeks to just roll it into the existing land use comprehensive planning process that occurs with the Metropolitan Council and the local units of government. And it also brings it a little bit earlier into the decade so that they're not, and that's made possible by technology and the fact that all this census information is available more readily, more quickly, and is far, far more useful to be working with more current census data and current development on the ground than stuff that's almost 10 years old. The comp plans are turned in, and so they're almost obsolete. So those are some of the steps we take to assist locals to do that. And the benefit is tremendous. I mean, there is some expense related to the administration of this effort, but the benefit in terms of costs in the tens of millions of dollars we forego in chasing leapfrog, you know, and not super well-planned development all around the metropolitan area will be brought down quite a bit.
Okay, we're going to hear from two other people, one to testify, who notified us, Anna Lee Garlitz from AMC and Patty Nauman from Metro Cities. Ms. Garlitz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Anna Lee Garlitz, and I work with the Association of Minnesota Counties. And I would like to start by thanking Senator Dibble for working with us and addressing the concerns. As introduced, we had many concerns with the bill, and we've been meeting with Senator Dibble and Representative Hornstein and working out a lot of the questions. So we've gotten a lot of clarifications made as we've worked through this bill. Counties will continue to have questions and have on the comp plans. It's a cost for counties. Right now we are required to do those, and this bill does set aside some money for that. And I anticipate that in future years, as we see how the Met Council develops their goals and objectives and how the University of Minnesota's model turns out, we will, of course, reserve the right to comment in future years as we see how that process works forward. But as written in this amendment, the main questions that counties have put forward have been addressed. And I'd like to thank you for working with us.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Garlitz. Questions for Ms. Garlitz?
Yes,
Senator Roebling.
Madam Chair, we just finished a round of comprehensive plans for all the counties, and I don't think they were scheduled to restart that process for a few years because it was supposed to be a 20-year plan, I believe. But now this bill calls for something by 2020 that all those plans be revised, or 2012. It looks like, I'm just wondering about that and what kind of a problem that is. And you mentioned that there might be some money to help do that, but this is a major undertaking whenever you revise a comprehensive plan.
Ms. Garlitz?
Madam Chair, Senator, that was something that we did discuss as we've been talking about this bill. As introduced, I believe the bill had updates required by 2013, and that was a large concern because we had, like as you noted, we have just updated the plans in 2008. So as we worked through this, we talked about how in the beginning part of the decade there'd be better census data available, but this would also allow local units of government to have some time to take a look at what the Met Council goals and objectives were, to take a look at the model. It's not 2013, but it does give some time and some flexibility by 2005. And by doing it in 2015, it would bump the timeline back to 2025 as well.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The process is every 10-year update, not 20 years. And this doesn't seek to amend the existing comprehensive plans that are being turned in right now, but rather when the process begins anew, some of these policy changes that we call for are made a part of the regular update process. And that's going to happen a little sooner, which is, frankly, a desire of local units of government to do these sooner in the decade rather than wait until the end of the decade.
Ms. Dowman.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you. My name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the executive director of Metro Cities. We represent about 85 metropolitan area cities before the legislature and the Metropolitan Council. We're the entity that closely monitors the Met Council on all that they do. We also appreciate Senator Dibble's willingness to work with the various stakeholders, including the cities, on this bill as it's been moving forward in the process. Like to speak just about a couple of things having to do with both the vehicle miles traveled reduction goals in the bill and the proposal to change the process for comp plan timelines. We do appreciate that from the original bill, which was requiring cities to open up their 2008 comp plans and essentially put these goals in and then resubmit them, we do appreciate that the bill now has moved off of that. The 2015 timeline does more closely align plans with the release of the census data, and that may make some sense. Our own Met agency's policy committee has discussed that as a possibility. We don't have a specific policy on that, but we have had conversations. That said, we are concerned that asking cities to accelerate their next round of comp plans in an era of diminishing resources could be problematic. I think for some cities it's not a problem, for others it is. I've heard both. Comp plan updates do take an incredible amount of staff time and resources, so it may be a problem for some cities. We do recognize that this bill does provide some resources for cities to help address some of those planning issues, and we appreciate that. In terms of the vehicle miles traveled reduction goals, we do appreciate that this bill has made some progress. We want to make sure that the goals recognize that one size does not fit all for all cities. The bill now says it's a regional goal. We do appreciate that. But most importantly, I think with this bill, these goals will require significant additional resources, particularly around transit and other planning and development needs for cities. If we're actually to get these goals to be attained, we're going to have to change the way we do business, and that's going to require additional state resources. So I would also add that right now there's already a lack of sufficient resources for cities to meet Met Council goals and objectives that are under the current comp plan requirements and various requirements of the Met Council. So I would like to make that clear that we do need additional state resources if we're to make these goals achievable. Thank you.
Mr. Johnson has also asked to testify from the League.
Thank you,
to the
Madam
committee.
Chair.
Please identify yourself.
Members of the committee, Craig Johnson, League of Minnesota Cities. Keep my comments very brief because many of my points would agree with what you just heard from counties and from the metro cities. Would add that the amendment that you approved, the A4 amendment, was heavily developed to address concerns that were raised in earlier testimony by local units of government. And that those changes that were made in that amendment actually do address all of the remaining concerns that I had raised with this bill at that time. What this really does is just moves mostly the comp plan earlier in the decade for the future decades, so that we're completing it by the fifth year of each decade instead of by the eighth. It actually still leaves local governments almost the same amount of time, 3 months less net, to complete their comp planning work, but it's done more quickly after the census data comes in, so that the data is more relevant, frankly, when we're using it.
So that might be an improvement even independent of this particular proposal relative to the census data. I mean, even if this wasn't going forward, someone might have been a good idea to come in with a bill that moves the comp planning process more up a couple of years. Are there further comments for any of the witnesses or for Senator Dibble at this time? Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I know that Senator Dibble has spoken about this bill as providing opportunities for people to work closer to where they live, to walk or bike or have, you know, choices not to use automobiles. But what is your opportunity, maybe someone else's restriction. And right now I think people do have that opportunity. They can choose to live close to where they work. They can choose to live where there's biking and walking trails. But I have a feeling that this bill is going to lead to restricting people who don't want to do that, who might want to live further out in the country, who might want some other choices, because we will be restricting land uses and development. And I have some real concerns about that, about telling people basically by housing availability where they're going to live. And it is of concern to me, and I am very uncomfortable with the bill.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olsen.
If I could address Senator Roebling's concern a little bit, is I think a lot of this is from the state demographer, Tom Gillespie, that our population is aging in Minnesota, and you know, this is really just providing
housing, the family units are growing up and they're changing, and I don't think in any way this bill is going to restrict somebody who wants to move out to Harris and live out in the country on 20 acres. But in the big picture, the population in our state is changing so much that I think it's an appropriate bill to look at these kinds of things. Because, you know, the individual who wants to move out, they can certainly do that. But in the, like I said, in the big picture, it seems like we're as a society, we're aging, and we have different requirements than we did 20 or 30 years ago.
Okay, I think we're ready to act on the bill. Senator Olsen,
sure.
Moves that Senate File 549 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Education. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to ask a minute about the motion.
Beg pardon?
Aren't we supposed to refer those bills to finance?
I consulted with Ms. Schaefer-Pellinen about this particular issue,
yeah.
And it needs to go to be dealt with by the education policy part. And then, even though they're in the same committee, we got that memo from
Mr. Watson,
and it's supposed to be to education, and then they would refer it to finance at that point.
Boy, Madam Chair, I'm really confused because this process, I ran into this with the Transportation Committee, too, is different than what Mr. Watson's memo seemed to imply. So I don't know. They'll figure it out.
Good luck.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I'm going to use
Ms. Schaefer-Pellinen's judgment on this one, that the proper thing, according to the rules right now, is to go to education. Senator Dibble, if we find out that we have interpreted that incorrectly, I would support a motion on the floor to send it to finance rather than to education. Would that be okay, Senator
Pappas? And Madam Chair, I had four bills today that were referred to the Higher Education Committee, and I thought they were supposed to go to finance. And I asked Senator Cohen about this. There's still a lot of confusion out there.
Okay, is that agreeable? That would be the. If that happens. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. I guess we had already voted on it, but just to be sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
I missed my opportunity to say no again.
And there being no further business before the committee, thank you for staying later. We stand adjourned.